This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat. My name is Marla Damati. On the show today, Vanuatu marks 40 years of independence from not one but two colonial powers.
It is my honour and pleasure to welcome you all to the formal ceremony to mark the independence of New Hebrides and the birth of the Republic of Vanuatu.
And the original freedom fighters and their children reflect on what this day means to them.
We were overconfident, in fact, that this would happen because our platform was that we have always been independent people.
My parents have had an enormous influence on me. They are the primary influence on who I am now and what I am doing and what I'm trying to do in politics as well.
That was Father Sethiraghavanu and his son, Vanuatu's opposition leader, Ralph Reganvanu. Coming up in 10 minutes, you'll hear from the Reganvanus about their journey to independence and hopes for the future of Vanuatu. And the PNG plane crash mystery that just keeps getting more mysterious as the director of the company to which the plane was registered was murdered several months before taking ownership of the aircraft. We'll bring you an update on the mystery surrounding the plane crash in about half an hour's time. But next, some of PNG's provinces are worried with the surge in COVID-19 cases in Port Moresby this week that they would not be able to handle an outbreak.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Many of Papua New Guinea's provinces are on high alert after a surge in the numbers of COVID-19 cases in the capital, Port Moresby. Authorities have now confirmed 65 cases in the country and two deaths. The PNG government this week banned all but essential domestic travel from the capital, but the local TV station MTV is reporting that flights to other provincial capitals are still continuing. Health authorities in some of these provinces are now calling on the national government to do more and also ban people from travelling on the main highway, that's the gateway to the Highlands region, to stop any potential spread. But one governor isn't so concerned with stopping people entering his province because he's confident in the protocols they have in place. Bethany Harriman reports from Port Moresby.
The news that more than 60 people infected with COVID-19 is sounding alarms throughout Papua New Guinea. Health authorities in the Morobe province have also announced a 37-year-old male who flew to the provincial capital Lae tested positive for COVID-19. He also works for the National Health Department. There is now a concern in Lae that there could be community transmission.
But we've given good awareness since the first wave in January. We've given it health education.
Miriam Kay heads up the Buimo Clinic in Lae City. She says locals have been told how to stay safe, but they aren't taking the message seriously.
A lot of ignorance happening right now because whatever we've taught them, it's not happening. Like social distancing, avoiding handshakes, the need to wash your hands, wear a mask, and eating right.
The Morobe Provincial Health Authorities have put the latest COVID case, along with 74 other health workers, in quarantine. At Lae's main Anga Hospital, CEO Kipas Binga is strongly urging people to wear masks.
At least have something to cover your mouth when you're in town or you're in contact with people around, or even if you are symptomatic with a cough or flu-like symptom.
Lae is connected to the populous Highlands region by the Highlands Highway, PNG's main transport artery. Morobe Provincial Health Advisor Mika Yawing says they've set up screening centres at the city airport and on the highway out of the province.
And if anybody we're going to make sure that, we test them. So those are the screening point is very important. So we'll make sure that, we control the movement of people.
In Mount Hagen, the biggest city in the Highlands region, the head of the Provincial Health Authority, David Vost, says they've been preparing for the potential arrival of COVID-19 since March.
We've got screening occurring at the Kagamurga Airport, which is the entry point for Western Highlands by air. And we've asked the controller he could restrict traffic on the highway to commercial traffic only, because we see Lae and Madang, of course, as a potential source of infection.
There's anecdotal evidence that as the situation worsened in Port Moresby, Many people left the city for their home provinces before domestic air travel restrictions came into force. While authorities around the country are taking the steps to stop the movement of people, East Sepik's governor, Alan Bird, says he won't prevent people coming home, but there are protocols people need to follow.
We did do some testing ourselves, and we had indications that COVID-19 had actually passed through our province earlier in January and February. I don't want to worry too much and start getting crazy because it's already come through. I think that we've got to start learning to live with it. That might sound a little bit harsh.
But in January, in the early days of the pandemic, he banned Chinese nationals from entering his province. Governor Bird says PNG doesn't have an aging population, so the risks can be manageable if protocols are followed.
We've got a very small aging population and a very small vulnerable population compared to Western countries, I would think. We don't have too many people living beyond 60. I've taken a flexible approach, study, understand it, and then move forward without destroying the economy in the process.
Papua New Guinea's already struggling health system will be put to the test, with the threat of the coronavirus moving government attention away from other diseases such as HIV and drug-resistant tuberculosis.
Bethany Harriman reporting from Port Moresby.
In times of health emergencies, it's important to have accurate information. Always check the source of information you read, and don't share information on social media or WhatsApp unless you are sure it's from a trusted source. To find accurate, up-to-date information about the coronavirus, search for ABC Radio Australia, the World Health Organization, or your country's government, online or on Facebook. Being well informed will help protect you and your community from the coronavirus.
On this day, back in 1980, Vanuatu gained its name and its independence. It took 7 decades for what had been known as New Hebrides under the British and French for Vanuatu to win its independence under the leadership of Father Walter Linney and the Vanuaku Party. Today, as the Pacific Island Archipelago celebrates 40 years of freedom, three people with a lot to celebrate are the Regan Vanus, Pastor Sethi, his Australian-born wife Dorothy, and their son, Vanuatu's opposition leader, Ralph Regan Vanu. Talia Alatia has the story.
Long power belong you, blessed President, more Prime Minister, blow me fella, long country, blow me fella, here, long Vanuatu.
After 74 years of joint British and French rule, Vanuatu became independent.
It was left to the traditional dancers from Tanna to perform, as for the first time the new flag of Vanuatu was raised over the nation.
Among those celebrating in the streets of Vanuatu back in 1980 were two of Vanuatu's original independence freedom fighters, Pastor Sethi and Dorothy Regan Vanu.
My name is Sethi Regan Vanu. I am one of many people at the time for independence who were working together as we struggled to get our freedom and right to get our political independence.
Pastor Sethi Regan Vanu was one of the early members of the New Hebrides National Party, founded in 1971, whose early platform was for independence. The party later became known as the Vanuaku Party, which means Party of Our Land, and is the country's oldest political party. Pastor Regan Vanu was Lands Minister in the last pre-independence government in November 1979.
We were overconfident, in fact, that this would have happened, because our platform was that we have always been independent people. Before white people came to Vanuatu, we were people who were living in our islands independently, depending on our subsistence agriculture and our way of life, culture, our custom and all that. So we were confident that with this background, with that spirit of independence, that we would get it. No, there was no doubt.
Pastor Regan Vanu says the church played an important role in Vanuatu's fight for independence.
Vanuatu, before independence, was under joint rule of Britain and France. Had it not been for what the churches were doing in terms of education, health, service, the new Vanuatu will never get what we got in 1980. The two governments could not agree to get Vanuatu politically going forward, because we're divided by the different factors. For example, the language of French language, English language, And, of course, our culture, we came from different islands and we still do. And so there were a lot of factors that separated us. And we had to try and work our way towards a common purpose, towards a unity of people to fight together to become one people and one nation as we have been the last 40 years. Many of us who were involved in struggle to get independence were products of the work of the church.
Father Walter Linney is no doubt one of the best-known churchmen involved in Vanuatu politics. As you can hear in this 1981 documentary, Yumi Winam Freedom, this was the moment Father Walter Linney was elected the Chief Minister.
Leimang 3, abstention 3, Linney 26. I declare that Father Walter Linney had been elected as new Chief Minister for the New Hebrides government.
Father Linney would go on to become Vanuatu's first Prime Minister once independence was gained. And it was also the church that brought Dorothy Reganvanu to Vanuatu.
I came to Vanuatu when I was about 25 or 26, but I came with the church to come and teach here. And when I got here, I saw the starting of the independence struggle, and I saw, like, the effects of colonialism, you could say, on the Indigenous people.
Having grown up in Australia, Dorothy Reganvanu was familiar with the Indigenous people's fight for land under colonial rule.
When I came here and I saw the same sort of thing happening, I was interested in supporting the independence. And then I got married before independence, and so I was very glad to assist. I think my assistance mostly just comes from because I am a teacher, and it comes through the people that I have taught. Because as a foreigner, I mean, as a white person, I didn't want to have any position of great authority or importance, but I think the way I contributed was by encouraging and educating many of the leaders that are now leaders in Vanuatu.
The Reganvanus have 5 sons, and Dorothy says it's a joy to see their son Ralph following in his father's footsteps.
I feel proud of all of them, but I'm glad that they are following in their father's footsteps and that the sort of values that we gave them, they are putting into practice.
Ralph Reganvanu is the current leader of the opposition in Vanuatu and the member for Port Vila, and he says his parents have been a huge influence in his life.
Clearly, my parents have had an enormous influence on me. They are the primary influence on who I am now and what I am doing and what I'm trying to do in politics as well. All my principles and what I stand for comes from them, and I'm very lucky and very fortunate. And I'm very fortunate also that now on the 40th anniversary that they're still here and they're still active and we're able to share this moment together.
On this 40th anniversary of independence, Ralph Reganvanu is not only looking back but also looking forward as well, and is using the Constitution, which his father helped draft, to help guide nation-building decisions and help tackle the modern challenges facing Vanuatu.
The elements of the nation that were established gave very strong evidence to custom, the traditional economy, Christian principles, values of being Melanesian, values of identity. And those are things that we haven't lost, but we've been trying to work out how do we balance them in a modern nation state with all those challenges. The big ones, obviously, are climate change and the COVID-19 pandemic. And so it's a good time to reflect back, re-energize, you know, those positive things that we want to take forward in our country and see, you know, how we can do things better to achieve what was the original vision of our independence leaders.
Those were the sounds of women singing in the street during Vanuatu's independence celebrations last week. Before that, you heard 3 members of the Reganvanu family, Pastor Sethi, Dorothy, and their son, Vanuatu's opposition leader, Ralph Reganvanu. That story was brought to you by Talia Olatia. And we'll hear from Vanuatu expats living in Australia later in the program, including one who's been forced to celebrate at home in lockdown in Melbourne because of COVID-19.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Time for a bit of music on this Thursday morning. This is Bird of Paradise by Boy and Bear.
In a bird of paradise, I found out I could drag you to fly to the salt in the air. Okay, with this world as it is.
That was Bird of Paradise by Boy and Bear. It's time now to have a look at the stories making news across the region and the world. And to do so, I am joined by Jordan Fennell this morning. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Marla.
How are you on this Thursday morning?
I'm doing well. A bit sleepy as always, but I'm here with some great stories.
I'm very excited to get into them. Now let's turn to PNG first, where the drama around SIM card registration seems to continue after the deadline to register has now been extended again. What do we know?
Yeah, so it's been extended for another month until the 31st of August. Emergency controller David Manning says that this is to allow access to information as there are growing coronavirus cases in the region.
And this SIM card registration saga has dragged on for years now. Now, refresh my memory and the memories of those listening with why people in PNG need to register their SIM cards.
Yeah, so when you register a SIM card, which is that small sort of computer-like chip that goes into your phone and essentially makes your phone work. It can't work without one. When you're registering it, the user is providing a mobile phone company with their name, their proof of identity, and other details like that. In many countries, SIM card registration is already part of the law, and the PNG government says that they want to adopt this to help mitigate security concerns and to address criminal and antisocial behaviours. They say that if you don't register your SIM card, then it will get deactivated. But providing proof of identity can be a huge issue for people in PNG, where many live in rural areas and don't actually have written identification like a driver's license or a passport.
And actually, to register a SIM, I've read accounts of people having to queue at a phone provider outlets like Digicel, complete a paper form, and have a staff member take a photo, which is not something that you want happening while COVID-19 cases are on the rise as well.
That's right. And I've actually seen photos on social media recently of crowds of people packed tightly together outside outlets like Digicel because that deadline was going to be the end of this month. And so they were gathering to register their SIM card just a couple of days ago, but with, you know, not wearing masks, not socially distanced. So, not what you want right now.
Absolutely. And it's a good reminder to everyone to always stay socially distant, wear a mask, wash your hands. And if you can stay home, please do so you can stop the spread of coronavirus. Now, turning to another story, earlier this week, Samoan man became New Zealand's first convicted slaver and human trafficker and was sentenced to jail. But his victims say that his punishment has been too light. What more do we know of the story?
Yeah, so actually, back on Monday, a Samoan chief called Joseph Matamata was found guilty of human trafficking and using 13 of his countrymen as slaves over a 25-year period. He was sentenced to 11 years jail time and then ordered to pay over $180,000 New Zealand dollars in reparations to his victims.
It is quite outstanding that this story has happened, and also that trafficking and human trafficking and slavery is still happening in that context at this time. Now, this is the first time anyone in New Zealand has been charged with both human trafficking and slavery at the same time.
That's right. He would bring small groups of people from villages in Samoa with the promise of horticulture work or schooling in New Zealand. Some of his victims were as young as 12, and his oldest victim was in his 50s. And then when those victims arrived in New Zealand, they actually ended up working really long hours, 7 days a week for Joseph Matamata. They weren't allowed to leave his compound and they couldn't speak to their families without his permission.
And now he has been found guilty, but what has his victims had to say about this?
So the Samoa Observer spoke with a woman who was taken to New Zealand by Matamata with her younger brother when she was just 15 years old. She said 11 years jail time is way too short a sentence for what he put them through. And relatives of other victims have spoken up saying that he hurt a lot of people and that he deserved a longer sentence.
Well, we'll see if there's any appeals or anything that's put forward in the case against Joseph Matamata, but it is such an incredibly important and interesting court case and story that you brought to us today. Now to some international news, and this is so interesting. Archaeologists have discovered the likely sources of Stonehenge's giant stones. There are so many conspiracy theories out there about about how the stones got there. I do go into a bit of a rabbit hole trying to read, you know, they said giants. Some people say, you know, they just appeared there. Some people say they were carved. What do the archaeologists reckon happened?
Yeah, it's really interesting. As we know, Stonehenge, there's not much known actually about what they're there for. People don't know. Historians don't really know. But those big stones that you see standing upright in Stonehenge are called sarsen stones. And while there are quite a few places across the UK where they could have come from, scientists have never actually been able to pinpoint exactly where these stones were mined from and where they came from. But recently, a sample of the Stonehenge stones, which was taken back in 1958, was handed back to researchers, and they used this sample to create a geochemical footprint of the stones. They analysed sarsen stones from 20 different locations in the UK, and they found that in the Westwoods of Wiltshire, which is an ancient woodland area where these days people go hiking and they have picnics and they go for bike rides, they found a direct match.
It's absolutely crazy and fascinating, but also, like I love to say, such an important example of how far science has come in terms of being able to footprint and see where all of these ancient, you know, artifacts and paintings come from. But it is quite crazy because Stonehenge is estimated to be more than 4,000 years old. And all these years later, they're still discovering new things about it. Now, how far away is that woodland area from the Stonehenge site? Because those stones are huge and everyone is not known how they could move them there.
Yeah, so there are 50 of those huge stones that are made of the sarsen stone from that woodland area. Those stones that are standing upright at Stonehenge weigh about 20 tonnes and they're 7 metres tall. And the Wiltshire woodland area is about 24 kilometres away. But scientists still have no idea how they were transported all those years ago. They're hoping now that they've found where the stones are from, they're going to do some more excavation to find if they can find the actual area where those specific stones were picked up from in the woodland area. And they're hoping they can find out more about what it all is about.
Well, I'd love to know more about Stonehenge because it's one of those places that still boggles my mind to this day. But Jordan, thank you so much for bringing us those stories.
No worries.
That was Jordan Fennell bringing us the stories from across the region and the world.
Religion and Ethics, Wednesdays at 5:30 p.m. on Radio Australia.
The shutdown of religious activity doesn't just affect the faithful. 20 of the 25 biggest welfare agencies in Australia are faith-based.
It is the case that the charities connected with the churches, and particularly its welfare agencies dealing with the homeless, youth, aged care facilities, all of these things are so critical for the wider community now, and the churches are at the forefront of them. They're not-for-profits. They're there because they believe it's their mission, because the Christian tradition is a tradition of care and compassion reaching out. So if those things start to suffer in such a way that they have to be closed down, that is extremely serious for the wider community. Having said that, it's remarkable how agile and imaginative the charities are.
Religion and Ethics, Wednesdays at 5:30 p.m. on Radio Australia.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Marla Damati. Now, more details have come to light about the dead owner of a mystery plane that was found wrecked and abandoned near Port Moresby this week. The plane flew from far north Queensland, wasn't cleared to enter PNG, and police say they're looking for an Australian man they believe to be the pilot. But mystery also surrounds the plane's ownership. The director of the company to which the plane was registered was murdered several months before taking ownership of the aircraft. Reporter Liam Fox has been digging around for the details on this very intriguing story. Liam, who is the owner of the plane and what have you found out about him?
According to Australia's Civil Aviation Safety Authority's aircraft register, the registration holder or owner of the mystery plane is a PNG company called Raven Pole No. 69. As we reported yesterday, a company search shows Raven Pole's sole director and shareholder is a man called Jeffrey Paul Bull. We also reported yesterday that several sources told Pacific Beat that Mr. Bull was murdered in Port Moresby last year. We've now confirmed that after obtaining copies of Mr. Bull's death certificates. One is a certificate of death from the Pacific International Hospital dated August 20, 2019. It says 56-year-old Mr. Bull was rushed into the hospital's emergency department by security guards with multiple stab wounds to his chest. CPR was performed but unsuccessful. Another certificate of death issued by PNG's registry office confirms those details and states that the cause of death was multiple stab wounds to the chest. It also notes that Mr. Bull's occupation was businessman and also president of the People's Democratic Movement Party. The PDM party is the party of former Prime Minister, now Western Highlands Governor, Pius Winkty. Mr. Bull is still listed as the party's president on PNG's Register of Political Parties. Now, back to the date of Mr. Bull's death in August last year. It's significant because according to the aircraft register I mentioned earlier, the mystery plane was registered to Mr. Bull's company, Ravenpol, on January this year. So that's 5 months after the company's sole director and shareholder was murdered.
Liam, this adds to the confusion surrounding the plane's ownership because the registered operator of the plane has also denied ever flying the plane, hasn't he?
That's right. The aircraft register I mentioned earlier lists both the registration holder or owner and the registered operator. In this case, the Cessna's operator is listed as Australian Aviation Company, Avlease. As we reported yesterday, Avlease's director, Ian Shire, told Pacific Beat his company has never flown the plane. He said he was at a loss to explain why Avlease is listed as the plane's operator, and he's written to the Civil Aviation Safety Authority seeking an explanation. We've also contacted CASA with queries about the plane's details, and we're yet to hear back. We've also made several attempts to speak to PNG police about what, if any, progress they've made in tracking down the plane's pilot, but so far there's been no response.
Liam Fox there.
ABC Australia iView is a free video streaming service from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation for users around the world. The ABC Australia iView app is available for download on iOS and Android devices. ABC Australia iView has content that will keep you in touch with what is happening in Australia.
We simply want to say to you, Australia, thank you. Keep doing it. You're saving lives and you're saving livelihoods.
As well as comedy, entertainment, education and English language learning content. You can also stream the ABC News Channel live through your device using this app. So to watch great ABC programs like Four Corners Foreign Correspondent and Gardening Australia, download the ABC Australia iView app now.
I think we should play a little bit more music on this Thursday morning. This is definitely a new favourite of mine. This is Soulflower by Noah Slee.
Knows you give the best pilot, and your firm fruit the rubble you've overgrown. You're my soul flower, you're my soul, you're my soul flower, you're my soul, you're my soul flower, you're my soul, you're my soul flower.
That was Soulflower by Noah Slee.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
The number of COVID-19 cases in the Pacific Islands may still be tiny compared to the rest of the world, but no country has escaped the economic fallout, and the latest report from the Asian Development Bank paints a very bleak picture. Back in April, the ADB was forecasting economic contraction of around 0.3%, but 3 months later, that figure has risen to 4.3%, while the prediction for tourist-based economies is is even more grim. And speaking to Richard Ewart, the lead author of the Bank's Pacific Economic Monitor, Ramel Rabanal says that modelling carried out by the Australian National University warns that 1 million people could be at risk of sliding into extreme poverty.
ANU colleagues, they use some simulations just to show how 20% reduction in household incomes can increase the number of people living in extreme poverty in the Pacific. We're still far from a 20% reduction in GDP and household incomes as of the moment, but if travel restrictions extend up to next year, then we might approach something along those lines. But I think what the analysis shows is that the extreme case where such a 20% reduction in household incomes can take place, then you can see the shocking figure.
In order to prevent that scenario, that economic modelling to become a reality, clearly economic stimulus packages are going to be very important. But the question people will be asking is, can Pacific economies provide that kind of stimulus, or do they need to look outside their own countries for assistance?
Since the start of the COVID-19 crisis, we have seen most, if not all, of the Pacific countries craft their respective economic response plans. And certain elements are common across these plans, wherein you have some form of income support for the unemployed, some form of credit support for affected businesses, some support for utilities to make sure that lifeline services remain available to the population. These types of things, I think, are more or less standard across the region. And those elements are definitely a step in the right direction. But if the COVID-19 crisis extends further, it's going to have to be a coordinated effort between governments and also development partners, making sure that these types of mitigation measures, social assistance support for vulnerable population in particular, will be provided.
Of course, ADB is very much involved in assistance with dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. But presumably this is not a bottomless pit, is it? And I mean, if the situation does continue to get worse, and in the Pacific, of course, they have so few cases in most countries, but yet they're still suffering the knock-on effect. So it's going to be very, very hard for them, isn't it?
When we look at the differing impacts, we see that the economic impact on the Pacific is perhaps the most severe or one of the most severe when compared to our other sub-regions in South Asia, Southeast Asia, and East Asia, Central West. This is mostly because governments in the Pacific acted early to prevent COVID-19 from making its way in any large outbreaks in the Pacific, given that safeguarding their health systems, which have a limited capacity, is of paramount importance. But the trade-off from this is that you do have much sharper impacts on the economic side, just because all of the safeguards that you put into making sure that you don't import the virus can have large impacts on the economy, particularly for the tourism-based economies in the Pacific. Places like Fiji, Palau, Vanuatu, Cook Islands, our latest assessment show the economic contractions are going to be close to, or if not over, double-digit rates in these countries.
Part of what's contained in this report looks at fiscal reforms in Papua New Guinea, but of course the COVID-19 situation in PNG has got considerably worse, and there are fears now as to just how big the problem might actually be countrywide. Clearly, if we look at PNG in isolation, their economic future, based on what we know so far, is going to be very, very tough, isn't it? If they get a severe outbreak of COVID-19, well, heaven knows how they'll cope.
We do have a policy brief in the monitor discussing the ongoing fiscal reforms in PNG that unfortunately, I think, are being stalled by the COVID-19 crisis. The government, I think, has rightly acted in terms of imposing the 2-week lockdown to make sure that their health system is not overrun. We show also in the report that comparative capacities of Pacific health systems in terms of hospital beds and availability of medical personnel, PNG still has work to do to expand capacities. And with the new lockdown imposed in the capital, there is going to be more impacts on the economic side. During the initial lockdown that happened, I think, in April and May, there was a survey by the PNG Business Council showing that businesses already recorded about 50% lower revenue due to COVID-19 restrictions. And a similar scenario is possible during this current lockdown. And primarily, the most affected sectors will be public transport and also the knock-on effects on other sectors like retail trade.
And looking ahead, your report talks about projected growth in 2021 of 1.6%, but that, you say, will rely on the reopening of international borders and the resumption of tourism, overseas labour trade activity. The Pacific Islands, to a large extent, are really being almost held to ransom by the rest of the world, aren't they? Because they can't move until the rest of the world does. They're trying to set up travel bubbles in Fiji and Vanuatu, for example, but they're not going to do too much, I wouldn't have thought, to regenerate the economy. So how much at risk do you think the Pacific Islands are?
We do note in the report that 2021 projection is still quite fluid. It will depend on a lot of factors, and key among these factors is just how quickly the COVID-19 situation globally is resolved. For example, if a vaccine is on the horizon anytime soon. But even then, we should point out that risks are heavily tilted to the downside, because even if travel resumes, it will happen gradually, and the Pacific probably need to have a wait and see attitude just to see how the travel bubbles, travel bridges in some of the neighboring countries are working out. Participation in these travel bubbles will require some strengthening in health systems capacities, increased testing capacities to do contact tracing and isolation if necessary. Those will have to be in place. And then, of course, if countries are in these travel bubbles, the next question would be how many travelers will actually be willing to travel in the early stages of next year and beyond.
You talk in the report about COVID-19 having a far greater impact on the economies of the Pacific than on the health sector. But as you pointed out there, that doesn't mean the health sector is not at risk and doesn't need upgrading. They have to be prepared for these travelers to come in if that's the way they're going to go.
That's right. I think that's a great point. Although the countries have done a good job of not having large-scale outbreaks and no cases in a lot of these countries, I think the COVID-19 crisis highlights the need to strengthen health systems across the board. Health information systems are in place, early warning, early detection, to make sure that hopefully it doesn't happen. But if another similar situation happens in the future, then the health systems across these smaller economies will be more prepared. And hopefully through strengthened health information and early detection systems, the trade-off between the health and the economic side will be a little bit less stark.
That was Ramel Rabanal, lead author for the latest edition of the Asian Development Bank's Pacific Economic Monitor, and he was talking there to Richard Hewitt.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
People across Vanuatu are gearing up for their Independence Day celebrations today, where tens of thousands are taking to the streets, donning the national flag and their custom dress. Vanuatu's COVID-free status means people are still able to gather in crowds for the 40th anniversary, but it's going to be a very different experience for the Nevans in Australia. Those who live in the city of Melbourne have had to cancel their plans because they're in lockdown and stuck at home, while some seasonal workers in regional parts of the country have been given the day off to celebrate. We've caught up with them, and here are their stories.
My name is Esther Tully. I am 33 years old. I am part Nevans. My dad is from Tana. Mum is Fijian. She went to work in Vanuatu, but yeah, and then she met dad.
Hello everyone, my name is Terry. I come from the island named Malakula. I've been here as a senior workers in Australia. We are fortunate to celebrate on the Independence Day.
I wasn't there back then, but I guess it was harder because, I mean, Vanuatu has its own Melanesian ways, like customs. Different islands have their own customs and all that. And I think that wasn't, they couldn't really leave their Melanesian ways back then because of the French and the English. And I think after the independence, they can, leave their own Melanesian or show their own Melanesian ways now a bit better now than before. And it means a lot to me because Dad was a pastor, and because Presbyterian Church was one of the first ones to step in and fight for our independence in 1977. And my mum as well, she was single back then. They were all mainly in the outer islands, so Santo, Malakula and Tana Island. There's a story about it was in Malakula Island. He was in the village called Litz. They had to hide the Vanuatu Party flag, which they were planning to pull up that flag on the 29th of November, 1977. And the opposition team was very violent back then. So they had to find ways to hide the flag and get it to the other villages to pull up on the same date at the same time. So he had to do that by hiding the flag in between taros and pretending it's just a bundle of cabbage for the chief in another village. Yeah, so he didn't get caught.
We live in three different villages here in Australia, but Approximately we are about 40 to 50 in Vanuatu. We decided to go and celebrate the celebration, the 40th anniversary of Vanuatu. Somewhere beside the river with all of us here. And then remember the days while they're celebrating in Vanuatu. We are small in Australia, but we decided to dress up to a local traditional ways of custom dances. So I've arranged with my boys here to dress up in a custom dances. It's a little bit cold here, but we decided to walk around and see and make some activities like custom dances.
It's actually not looking good at all. We're in one of the hot spots in the Hume, so it's not good, but it's not it's not stopping us to celebrate. I mean, the Nivan students here, we're planning a brief Zoom session just to say hello and remember the day. And also the expats or the Vanuatu Fellowship members here in Victoria, they're doing they're writing out their speeches and they're sharing that online via email just because most of them are not on Facebook. So we are doing something, but just no contact and all that until a later date.
I do hope that we'll enjoy. And also we will, after all, we can talk about it also to our families back at home in Vanuatu. But even though we are very far away from them during the COVID-19, but we are happy to join them celebrating the 40th anniversary of our independence.
Me and my family, we are having island food, definitely a lap lap or tuluk and all that. But it'll be just the three of us, me, my partner and my son. There'll be lots of FaceTime with the families overseas. And also online streaming from VPTC in Vanuatu. So that's all we can do for now.
My hope is that for another 40 years, so we all in Vanuatu are looking forward for many developments so that we can access us all from what we're going to do for the next 40 years. And we hope that we will achieve by our government, our Teikathan, and give us opportunity to develop our country.
Well, I hope they can further develop their own resources or what they have. I know this is bad, but I mean, to stop getting aid from, especially New Zealand and Australia, and maybe stand by themselves for, in 40 years' time or in the future.
That story is produced by Catherine Grau. And please let us know how you're celebrating, whether you're in Vanuatu or somewhere else in the Pacific or even here in Australia. We'd also love to see your photos. Head to the ABC Radio Australia's Facebook page and you can share them there. Facebook user Tim Tim in Tanalu Village has messaged us with some of his photos of preparations for the West Efate Area Council celebrations today, with a stage set up right along the road with lots of posters and Vanuatu flags. Thank you there, Tim Tim. He also says that in the coming years, they're hoping to see development in their area, which is around 45-minute drive from the capital, Port Vila. And Philip in Solomon Islands has sent his independence greetings to his Vanuatu Wantoks. Thanks for sharing that with us, Philip. Milroy and Abraham have also said a happy 40th anniversary to Vanuatu. And I wanted to play a bit of music from Nivan artist Vanessa Key with her song Beautiful Pacific Islands.
Beautiful lovely islands, the lovely islands.
That was Vanessa Key, Ni Van Artis, singing Beautiful Pacific Islands.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
That's the program. Don't forget that Richard Hewitt will be along at 3 p.m. PNG time for the afternoon edition of Pacific Beat. Keep listening to ABC Radio Australia across the day and make sure you follow and like ABC Radio Australia's Facebook page. If you want to listen back to any of the stories today, head on over to our website and just search in Pacific Beat into your preferred search engine and you'll be able to find us there. A happy Independence Day to all Nivans around the world. I'm Ala Damati. Thank you for your company and I hope you stay safe and well.